Stein. Reel one. So, Hedy, here we are again, and this, I think, is the third interview you've very kindly given the Imperial War Museum about your Holocaust experience.
Well, it's very hard to do this for me.
And why I've asked you, you know, to come today is because I understand you've been back to Germany since we last met 2 years ago.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could tell me about that. Was this the first time you had returned to Germany?
No, it was not the first time. It was probably the sixth or seventh time that I've been back to Germany. The first time was in 1945, when I went back to work for the American government, and I was there from July 45 until March 48. The second time was in 1970. Primarily to show my husband and my son where I lived and went to school and so on. The third time was in 1980. In September 1980, I went back to work to visit the various camps where my parents had been. And one of them was Stockholm, where my father was, right after Crystal Night. And that was only a very brief stay. And then the next time was in October 1990, when the village where I come from, which is Kippenheim, invited all the survivors to come back. I then returned in January of 1991 spend some time with a man that I had known in England, and we had had a very close and intimate relationship then, but then somehow it separated me. He was a widower at that time, and I was divorced, and we were thinking maybe we could make a go of it, but that didn't work out. And then I came back again in June of 1991, when I was on a speaking tour in Northwest Germany. And then this last time was in October of 1997, when I was on a speaking tour in Southwest Germany as well as in Northwest Germany. In Southwest Germany, I was invited by the German Israeli Labor Circle of Southwest Germany. And I gave 20 presentations between October 6th and October 22nd on two topics. One, my own Holocaust-related experience, excuse me. And the second, about the medical experiments that the Nazis conducted. And then between the 27th and 29th of October, I gave four more presentations in Northwest Germany at the invitation of a women's group that is called, the translation would be, the Black Widow Spider. And I talked about four different topics there, one time each. One about my own Holocaust-related experience, the second about the medical experiments that the Nazis conducted, the third about Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and I'm currently co-chair of the St. Louis branch of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And the fourth talk was about the political situation in Nigeria and shale oil's connection in devastating the environment and devastating the population in the Ogoni land, and the political refugees that are in this country, as some of them are, about 10 of them are in St. Louis, and I'm in a support group for these Ogoni people who are political refugees in St. Louis.
So could I ask you about your Holocaust content of these talks, Hedy? I understand you went back, did you not, to your village?
Yes.
Kippenheim.
Yes.
Yes. Would this have been the first time you had been back there for any length of time?
It's the longest that I was in or near the village. But the first time that I was back there was in August 1947, when I went there. My main focus then was to look for my parents.
Yes, I think perhaps we covered that on earlier interviews, didn't we? Yes.
And then the second time was in 1970 when I wanted to show my husband and son where I grew up. And then I was there in October 1990 when the village invited the survivors to come back. And then in October of 1997. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Was this a different sort of visit for you, do you think?
Each one has been different. This time, in some ways, it was less emotional, and in many ways, it was tremendously emotional, because there were events that I could not have anticipated ahead of time that took place, which had a tremendous emotional impact on me. And I'm not a person that would normally display my emotions, but there were a couple of times when I actually openly wept in front of the audience. On October 8th was the first time that I revisited the former synagogue in Kittenheim. The synagogue has been restored, the exterior of the synagogue has been restored beginning in 1985, primarily at the behest of the then and current mayor, Mayor Matis, who is a wonderful man. And the village at that time in 1985 purchased the building, which during the war had been used as a place where prisoners of war were housed. And then after 1945, it was purchased by a former Nazi of the village, probably still Nazi at the time. And he used it to store agricultural things, amongst them manure. And exterior has been completely restored to the way it formerly looked. The interior has been cleaned up, and some repair has been made where perhaps the wall is beginning to deteriorate so that it won't deteriorate further. But you can really see how what has happened. It looks pretty terrible. And there's discussion going on whether to restore the interior or whether to leave it as is. And I was asked right when I first got there what my opinion is. And I then stated that, first of all, I don't have an opinion at this point. And also, I didn't feel I had a right to express my opinion. But by the time I spoke there the last time, which was on October 22nd, I strongly felt and expressed it that this, it should remain, the interior should remain as is, to show how it had been desecrated. I don't know what will happen ultimately. It is being used for lectures and for exhibits.
Yes, I was going to ask you, Hedy, are there any Jewish people living?
No, there are no Jewish people coming back, and no Jewish people live there, and that's why it is not used as a place of worship. But it is being used, and it's being used fairly regularly. I gave my first presentation there on October 8th, 1997, to the children. What used to be the family grade school that I attended is now the grade three middle school. And the principal of that school felt that I should talk to the children in the synagogue rather than come to the school. And as I entered the building, I stopped at the door and looked around, and I suddenly had a flashback to a time 69 years earlier when I was about 4 years old, and it had to be on one of the Jewish high holidays because those were the only two times that my parents attended the synagogue and I would go with them. And men and boys were downstairs, women and girls were upstairs. And I could see my father from where we were upstairs. And I remember whispering to my mother, I would like to go downstairs and be with my father. And my mother explained to me that I couldn't, and because downstairs is only for boys and girls. But I repeated that I want to be downstairs. I want to be with my father. And she again explained to me and cautioned me to be quiet. And in a somewhat louder voice, I said, I want to be a man and I want to be downstairs. And my mother, shh, be quiet. And in a still louder voice, I finally screamed on top of my voice, I want to be a man and I want to go downstairs. And my mother very quickly picked me up and took me out. And outside, I promised that I would be very good and that I understood that I couldn't be downstairs and I would be quiet. And so we went back in, and as soon as she opened the door, I screamed and clapped my voice, I want to be downstairs and I want to be a man. And so she took me out again and she had to take me home. Because she could no longer trust me that I would be quiet. And I, at the end of my presentation to the children, when they left, I walked over to the approximate place where my father used to sit. And I was thinking, you know, now I can be downstairs. But it wasn't how I had imagined it when I was 4 years old. And the joy that I would have felt when I was four of being downstairs just wasn't there. It was rather sad and painful. But I'd like to get back to my presentation to these children. When I completed my talk, And then there was a question and answer period, and at the end, the children started to get up, getting ready to leave, when the moderator, who is also the man who arranged my visit over there, Robert Christ, who on a volunteer basis heads the German-Israeli Labor Circle of Southwest Germany, said, just a moment, there's one more thing. And I had no idea what it would be, but I saw a man get up in the rear, and he carried a long, narrow object. And I had already given several talks prior to this, and each time I'd been given a gift, and I thought, oh no, he's giving me this gift. How on earth am I going to put this in my suitcase? Because it's so long, it won't fit. And as he walked towards the front, he put on the skull cap, the kippah, and the moderator, Robert Christ, also put on a kippah. And I just didn't understand. I was really puzzled. And by the way, the man that was carrying this object, his name is Mr. Erb. And when he came to the front, he unwrapped it and he handed it to me, and I realized then what it was. And I guess I need to backtrack to explain what it is. In 1938, during Kristallnacht, the men and boys in Kippenheim were arrested and first taken to Village Hall. I learned about a year ago that the Torah scrolls, which are perhaps the holiest of the holiest in Judaism, they contain the five books of Moses, were taken out of the synagogue and brought to village hall, where the men were in the back, in the backyard of the village hall, and some of the men were wrapped in the Torah scrolls. They were later on unwrapped as they were being marched from village hall to the railroad station. By the time they arrived at the railroad station, the Torah scrolls were hung like curtains on the platform of the railroad station for the men to see before they boarded the train on their way to Bethlehem. There, in January of 1997, there was an event in the former synagogue to commemorate the liberation of Auschwitz. And Mr. Ehrlich, at that time, presented the piece of Torah scroll to Robert Christ. And he explained the history of this piece of Torah scroll, that on November 10th, 1938, a man, whose name I do not know, found the piece of Torah scroll a few yards away from the railroad station. He picked it up and took it home and put it in a large box of sand that he had in the attic. It was there for fire protection. And the box had a huge swastika on it. He explained to his wife what he had done. And his Torah scroll remained in this box of sand. The man subsequently died. And Mr. Earp and his family moved in. And 15 years ago, he found this piece of Torah scroll in the box of sand. And he spoke to the man's widow, who told him the story of how this came to be in this box. And Mr. Earp knew it was something very sacred and valuable, but he didn't know what to do with it, and so he just held on to it. But in January of 97, he presented it to the German Israeli Labor Circle. And I knew about this. I had received a newspaper clipping from Mr. Christ, so I knew what it looked like approximately. And I had written to him and said, when I come to Germany, I would like to see it. And he said I would, but we had not set a time when this would happen. And then on the 8th of October, at the end of my presentation and the question and answer period, Mr. Earp presented this piece of Torah scroll to me. And I was just literally dumbfounded. You know, he urged me to take it, and I hesitated. Not out of religious reasons, but I was just awestruck. Should I? Could I touch this? Is this maybe a piece of Torah scroll that my father was wrapped in? I don't even know if my father was wrapped in a piece of Torah scroll. But he encouraged me, as well as Mr. Christ, that I hold it. And so at that point, I just started to cry. As I talk about it now, it's... And then Mr. Christ asked me to hold one end of it while he unrolled it and held the other end of it. There was media there at the time, and so there were a lot of photographs. I do have some concern about this piece of Torah scroll because it's been not only then, but subsequently, it was handed to me again when I spoke, and the concern is being handled too much, and it needs to be protected. It needs to be in some kind of a protective case. And I've expressed that when I was there and also since my return.
What will happen to it, do you think, Hedy? What will happen to this portion of Torah?
I don't know. I have told them they should contact a museum and find out how one protects it, how it, you know, should have be in some kind of case. And, you know, since they do have, even now, some displays on the walls of what the synagogue looked like, what it looked like after November 1938 or so, this should be in a case on the wall there. And, you know, if it should, can be shown in other places, it needs to be transported very carefully. I don't know what's going to happen to it. I have real concerns about that. I have, about a week ago, I gave photographs that I have of this toy store and some of them are close-ups. I've given them to a local guy because I would like to know what part of the Torah it is. Is there some mystical connection with what happens in the Torah? If that happens, then the way it is hidden, the way it is found, the way it is presented to me, I don't know. I don't have that answer yet. The second time this Torah scroll was handed to me was on October 22nd in the evening when I gave my last talk in the synagogue to a primarily adult audience, though there were young people there too. And it was an overflow audience. It was also, I was told, the very first time that the mayor and the public came to an event that had taken place inside the synagogue. And I was handed this Torah scroll at the end of my presentation and asked to explain to the people what the history of the Torah scroll is. And I did. And again, I broke down when I started talking about how the men were wrapped in it and what I just talked about.
That would be the greatest sacrilege, would it not?
Yes. They did talk to Robert Price, talked to a rabbi before I came to Germany, because he knew, and he seems to be very knowledgeable about things Jewish, although he's not, he's Catholic. But I, in fact, in a joking way, I said to him, I make him an honorary Jew. He knew that when a Torah scroll has been desecrated, it needs to be buried and it cannot be used anymore. And he discussed that with the rabbi, and the rabbi said, that's true, but this is a very special kind of piece, and the history of it is very special. And it, he felt it could not or should not be buried. Because it's one thing to talk about it in the abstract and to maybe show a photograph, but to really see this and for me to be able to actually touch it. Yeah, I've never touched a Torah scroll in my life. And, you know, it's just, even though I'm not religious, it was just something. And this particular piece was even more so really special to me because of its history.
Yes, I can well understand, Hedy, you know, what an emotional experience that must have been, given the meaning of the Torah and, you know, its connection with Kristallnacht and the men. Were there any other? You were saying earlier that there were quite a few emotional moments for you
right.
in the synagogue.
Right.
Could you tell me about the others?
There were two more. The first one was kind of, they were both pre-arranged because I wanted to do that. And the first one was on the eve of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that would have been, I think, if I remember correctly, the 10th of October, the evening of the 10th of October. I lit some candles in the synagogue, but I want to explain why I did that. In 1956, I received some information from the French organization that both of my parents were deported, allegedly deported, to Auschwitz on the 11th of September, 1942. And at that time, I went to a rabbi and asked what date in the Jewish calendar was the 11th of September, 1942. And I was told it was the eve of Yom Kippur. And because I remembered that my parents used to, not my parents, my mother used to light a candle for her deceased mother on the anniversary date of my grandmother's death. I felt that maybe this is what my mother would like me to do also. I know my father never lit a candle for his father, who died many years before. But I felt I couldn't light one only for my mother and not for my father. So since 1956, I have lit 2 candles every year at home and the very eve of Yom Kippur. And since I was going to be in the village, I had asked ahead of time that I wanted to light the candles in the synagogue. And there is one place in the synagogue, it's the only place there where there's sort of an outcropping from the wall near the entrance door, where I understand candles used to be lit. And there's still a Jewish or Hebrew inscription there in gold. And it's the only place where you can still see that this was a Jewish place of worship or a place that had some kind of Jewish connection. And just a few people were asked to be there. I lit the 2 candles for my parents there. And I had explained to the people there why, what I was doing and why I was doing it. And I just asked them to observe quietly, without saying anything. And that was the first time. And the second time was on the 22nd of October, after I gave my presentation to the audience, which was primarily adult, with some young people there. And the reason I did it on the 22nd of October, because that on the 22nd of October, 1940, my parents and other family members, as well as all Jews from this section of Germany, from Southwest Germany, were deported from the village. And most of those people did not survive. And so I explained that I wanted to light 2 more candles there for all of those people who were deported at that time, both those who did not survive, as well as the few who did survive. And what was amazing to me was that it was a totally full house. People were sitting on the floor around me and behind me. People were standing in the back. Some people had to be turned away because there was no room there. And I spoke from the front. And this outcropping from the wall where I was lighting, had lit the candles earlier that month, is in the back. And so we asked that people make room that I can walk to the back. And it was, I can only compare it to the parting of the sea when the Israelites were fleeing Egypt. all of a sudden there was space, lots of space, for me to walk to the back and to light those candles.